Welcome to Accounting High.
We are a firm that specializes in working with the restaurant space.
And then March of 2020, the world shuts down. Nobody can go to restaurants. Restaurants are closed.
One of the partners is suggesting that we close down for the weekend. And so I was like, that seems excessive. And this is Thursday night. And so we're like, yeah, it'll probably blow over. Well, Saturday morning, I distinctly remember that everything had changed. And we were talking with every single one of our clients by that morning and talking about doing mass layoffs and furloughs. So in the span of 72 hours, we went from thinking that this wasn't going to be a huge deal to a catastrophic disruption of the entire industry.
May I have your attention, please?
We were spending a little over 40 hours a month on manual data importing, exporting, and manipulation. And within a few hours of playing with Geocon, that problem was eliminated.
You can connect somebody that has three businesses. You can connect one sheet.
They'll have the holding company and then a couple of operating companies and then the management company, all the different things that we set up for tax purposes. They want to see the roll-up. And so Geocon allows you to do that. The consolidation for the roll-ups is ridiculous. You set the template up one time, and then you just copy and paste it across.
Even if they had one business in Xero and businesses in QuickBooks, you could still connect it all to one sheet.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. And so we've eliminated each of the problems. So problem one, 40 hours a month with the data manipulation. We've also got the issue of human error that gets involved in that process. And then another thing, just from the client's perspective, to have that consistent deliverable every single month, it really does elevate the perception of the value of the brand. And we were able to eliminate all of that with one platform. And that's why we've been with them for years.
We didn't even talk about the two-way, the second part of the sync, is you can upload a bunch of data into your sheet or pull it from one place, manipulate it a little bit, and then push it into QuickBooks too, which is solving a different problem.
Especially if you're offering accounting services as well. Manipulate data outside of QuickBooks. You can make a lot of those changes right in Google Sheets, and it's automatically going to push them back. The best use case I've seen of that is those Ask My Accountant items, you know, where you get a list for your clients. They tell you what category they go into. Normally, you'd have to take that list, go back into QuickBooks, update everything based on the client feedback. You can connect your chart of accounts right to your client dashboard in Google Sheets, make those updates, and it's going to automatically push those chart of accounts updates back in, so you don't have to go back and manually do it and double the work.
That's incredible. Not only is it great for the CFO forecasting reports, dashboards, and manipulation of that aspect of the data, the viewing of the data, but also on the back end, manipulating it and getting it in there so it is correct. It works hand in hand and on the back end and on the front end.
I'm a big fan of simplicity. I'm very protective of the platforms that I add to my firm. I mean, we seven-figure firm. My tech stack is literally Carbon, Ignition, Geocon.
Oh, wow.
That's it. That's what we use. So I'm like, this is worth its weight in gold. You got to check out Geocon. It's just it's a no-brainer.
No-brainer, yeah. But I love this. So Geocon, for anybody listening, check them out. It's acon.services.
May I have your attention, please?
Welcome to Accounting High. It's freshman year at a brand new school. Here, we have no rules in place as we're on a mission to set our own traditions. So hang tight and learn with us as we grow. At Accounting High, you can expect to gain knowledge in a completely different way than what you may be used to, with some fun and oftentimes colorful conversations. Whether you loved high school or you hated it, here's your chance to be a part of an unforgettable experience redone. While you're here, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you may be listening to us right now so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And feel free to leave us a 5-star review letting us know how the school year is treating you. In addition, share this episode on social media tagging us at Accounting High. So sit back, relax, and open your mind because class is in session.
I repeat. May I have your attention, please?
This is another public service announcement brought to you in part
by Accounting High.
The views and events expressed here are
of the next generation of accounting and tech professionals leading this space.
The events and suggestions are not to be taken lightly. Children should not partake in the listening
of this podcast.
Anything else?
Yeah.
So without further ado, introducing the star of our show,
Scotty and Chris.
We're going to have a problem here.
Class is in session, and we have Chris Maxey.
How you doing?
What's up, homie?
I'm just trying to stay dry out here in New England today after like day 34 of rain.
We had floods, flash floods yesterday here, but it rained for maybe less than 20 minutes. I got all these alerts on my phone, like flash flood warning. Like it was ramping up to it. I thought it was going to be a whole day of rain, and we had maybe like 18 minutes of rain and then sunshine all day. So sorry to hear that. You've had 34 days of rain.
Yeah, it's just monsoon season over here.
Monsoon season up in Vermont. So Christopher, enlighten our audience. Tell me the name of your firm. Tell me roughly, give me some numbers of your firm and what you guys do. Maybe top line numbers, employees, stuff like that.
Yeah. So I am the CEO of Prefix Accounting. We are a firm that specializes in working with the restaurant space. We work with everything from full service to limited service restaurants. Generally, they're independent, so no franchises or anything like that. We're about $1 million in revenue, and we have 12 employees, and okay. We're fully remote.
So the key takeaway there is you led with, you work with restaurants. You didn't lead with, we do taxes and accounting, or we do this and that, we do CAS. You said, we work with restaurants. And then you specified the types of restaurants that you work with too.
Yep.
That is beautiful. That is today's episode. We're going to talk about finding your niche. Now, for anybody that doesn't know, I found my niche. My niche is rapping for accountants or doing podcasts for accountants. I work with and talk about accounting on this show and things tangentially associated with this show. But at my firm, we don't have a niche. We have not picked a niche. We've been talking about it for years and years. Mm. I've talked about it on this show. I know all the steps and all the things that you should do with finding a niche. But for some reason, I grew my firm horizontally. We had a vertical of, here's the software that we use. We took clients on based on them using the software that we use, which is Xero, which you guys don't use at all. You guys are all QuickBooks. And I think we got lost somewhere along the way in just growing based on certain client types and certain personality types. And we never picked that industry vertical. And I think everything gets easier for a firm that wants to grow and be profitable and build systems and pick tools and pick clients, all of those things become easier when you pick that industry vertical. So tell me first how you got started. I'm just setting the stage here really, but first tell me how you got started in accounting, you know, in this, are you CPA and how you got started in this to be owning this business first? And then we'll talk about picking that niche.
Yeah. So, I went to business school, but I did not major in accounting. Did a lot of accounting in high school, actually, because we had a tech school, and swore to myself that I would never in my life be an accountant. That was the one rule I had. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I didn't want to be an accountant.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have any trauma, like in the family? Anybody was an accountant in your family?
Anything? No, I just thought that would be an incredibly boring job.
Wouldn't it?
So I swore that off. And when I had graduated from school, I had already been working in the hospitality space through college because it was a good way to make, you know, some extra beer money through the summer and winter.
Did you wait tables? Did you bartend? What were you doing?
Back of house. So I'd worked doing dishes and then had been working on the line for a few years.
I could see you as a line cook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was like my, that was like what I would do through the summers and winters, because that lined up well with how busy restaurants were where I was from.
Lined up well, no pun intended.
Yeah. And so after I graduated from school, or around the time I was graduating from school, it was still like post 2008 recession and the economy wasn't great. And so there wasn't a ton of hiring happening in the business space outside of like sales. And I knew I didn't want to do that. And so I basically said, all right, well, I'll just go back to the hospitality industry and kind of wait this out. And so many years later, I, you know, was in my late 20s at this point in time. And I had decided that I didn't, I wanted to get a big kid job, because that's like one of the things that like is a stigma in the hospitality industry, is that you have to go out and get a real job, and that hospitality isn't a real job, which is, could not be any further from the truth.
But it is a stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when I was in hospitality, I always saw it as the stopping point. I always saw it, you're doing this to get you through something else, whether it's school, you know, or you're trying to be an actor or whatever it might be, like going into entertainment. People are always using that as the stopgap. I'm doing this before I do big things with my life, or before I do the next thing. Nobody really saw it as the career.
Exactly. And it, there's such a, like a gravity towards that, that like, it's not a real profession, when in the reality, like in the modern day, it totally is. That whole narrative has really changed quite a bit with like media popularizing the hospitality industry, like The Bear and shows like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had went to work for a bank for a year after I departed from the hospitality industry, immediately hated it. I hated it with every fiber of my being. Like a
it
week
had to
into
have been
it.
So boring compared to like working at a restaurant. You show up and it just flies by.
Yeah.
Flies by, especially if they're busy.
Yeah. And like I worked in restaurants where you would work 80, 100, 120 hours a week easily, and it flies by. I mean, you're destroyed physically and mentally from it, but it flies by.
Yeah.
And you go to working for a bank and it just feels like, all of a sudden, like time just like stops, and 40 hours feels like an eternity.
Yeah.
At a bank. So I went to go back to the restaurant industry, went back to the same.
Well, what did you do with the bank?
I was a mortgage officer,
okay.
Loan officer. Yeah. And so I went to go back to work for the restaurant group that I was, had been with previously. And the owner said to me, why don't I connect you with my accountants? And so I got connected with the firm that I'm with now, which at that time was called Custom Business Solutions, which was a bookkeeping firm for anybody, generalist firm.
For anybody, yeah.
And that is when I started working in the accounting industry. So it's only been 7 or 8 years since that point in time.
Oh, wow. So you started at Custom Business Solutions. Mm-hmm. Which was custom to, we'll take any client on and we'll customize your bookkeeping and your CAS, shall I say that?
Yeah.
Customize your books.
Mm-hmm.
You started there. What were you doing there?
So I had just started basically as a bookkeeper and doing some operations for the day-to-day for the firm. And it's owned by Lucy Pavlock and Carolyn Jones. And at that point in time, we were looking at taking on any business, and we had a decent amount of business. That's Curry.
See, and Curry?
Curry.
So for those of you not watching, we've got a dog that looks like the Dogecoin dog. It looks exactly like the Dogecoin dog walking around, and the dog's name is Curry. Coincidentally, I don't know if it's curry as in the food seasoning, like mm-hmm. spice.
It is.
Yeah, it's the spicy dog.
Spicy dog.
Yeah.
Spicy corgi. But we had clients that ranged from anything, from like a retail shop to a construction company and all those sorts of things, which was fine, but it wasn't, you know, there's a lot of variety in what you had to do because you're custom, right?
Yeah.
And so after a number of years being a generalist, we started asking ourselves the question of like, what clients do we really, truly care about? And that answer was the restaurant industry. And we had started with saying, like, which are the ones that we care the most about? So we went from, like, anybody and started narrowing our focus down.
Ooh, okay.
So it wasn't an overnight thing where we just suddenly, like, snapped our fingers and we're like, we're a niche firm now and we're only dealing with restaurants. This transition happened over the course of, like, you know, 3 or 4 years until the point in which we finally were like, we had a few legacy clients left and we're like, why, like, just double down on it and only focus on the hospitality industry.
So your client makeup, your client base, when it was custom, how many restaurants did you have at that point? Because you came through the connection with the restaurants.
It was probably like 6 or 7 of them out of like 40 clients or so.
Okay. Okay. And you just kept paring down, which clients do we care about? Which clients do we love? And it was those 6 or 7. Those
yep.
were, what was the common trait about them? Was it the work or was it the people that owned it? Like, was it the owners? What was it?
It was, to start with, it was an industry that we were all passionate about. Like, we'd all been working in that industry at one point or another. It was the food culture. I hate the word, but like, the foodie culture was like already there for us. That's something that we already were really passionate about. And so it was just a matter of recognizing that and like distilling that. And so there are certain things about the hospitality industry that attracted us outside of that as well. And the reality of it is that the people that run restaurants are incredibly dedicated to their craft. They are loyal and they like to share the people that they love with other people. So the referral structure is super strong there. Mm-hmm. Restaurant people love talking about people that they like to work with, whether it's their vendors that they work with for buying wine or their fishmonger or even their refrigeration repair guy. They like hooking up their friends with other good people.
Yeah.
And so if you kind of dip your toe into that water, you instantly are just generating a ton of, you're building a
network. Base, yeah.
Yeah. That's really, really strong and special.
Well, it's still, so clarify for me, you know, when you guys first started, it was like 6 out of 40. Mm-hmm. And then you said 3 years later, you doubled down and you got rid of any legacy clients. So
yeah.
Give me the lay of the land of how that looked, because you couldn't just say, we're going all in on this, peace out, other mm-hmm. 34 clients, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yep.
you still have to service them, but losing or paring down 34 clients over 3 years, that's still a lot.
Yeah.
You know, all things considered.
It was a pretty immense change. Essentially, what we ended up doing is we started to partition some of those legacy clients off. And so some of our more senior members of the team took on some of those legacy clients. Carolyn had a really strong billable base in with a lot of those legacy clients. So a lot of that got concentrated with her. Meanwhile, all of the new clients that we were taking on were only restaurants. And those folks were getting paired with our newer team members. And so we did it in a way that we weren't necessarily exposing our newer team members to having to deal with all of the different things that you have to do for all of those legacy clients, and just train them on how to do the accounting for restaurants.
Okay.
And it was a gradual thing. Like, we would take on more clients, realize that we would hit capacity, and we would let some of our legacy clients go, take on more clients, hit capacity, let legacy clients go.
So rather than just hiring new people, you churned through your clients through attrition. You just kept building back your base of just restaurants.
Correct. We were
didn't let still, it get out of hand. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And we were still hiring, but we we realized pretty quickly that we couldn't hire fast enough to meet with the demand. So we would hire somebody, and if we find ourselves hitting that capacity level, we'll let go of a few legacy clients so that we're not, losing that company culture and the amount of training that we're doing by hiring too many people too fast.
Now, was all of this pre-2020?
Yeah, a lot of it was pre-2020.
All right, because I want to get into there too, because that was always people's big fears of going into a niche is something would happen that would impact all of your clients. That was that pre-COVID, that was my fear. You know, pick a niche, and what happens if that industry is affected by an external event? So you're growing, and you said to keep up with demand. Where was the demand coming from? Was it all just referrals, or did you guys start marketing to restaurants?
We haven't done any serious marketing. We've done presence marketing. So the validation that you're there, you're updating your socials to because obviously people are going to creep on you. You'll get a referral. One of your clients will say, hey, you should talk to them. And then that person then turns around.
They'll keep an eye on you for a year.
Exactly. And so that's the only marketing that we really have been doing. And we do a lot of webinars and things like that so that people can kind of understand what we're about to kind of keep the lead warm for a while. But that's really it. We're not doing any paid search. We're not doing anything like that. We don't have the capacity for it, really, because our lead funnel is so strong with referrals right now.
That's awesome. That's a pretty good feeling too, because it only gets better as you take on more clients.
Yeah.
And that's, so what's your, we'll get there. We'll get to that question. So as you're doing this, as you're growing, what was your role?
I had been operations manager for a long time. It was only until 2020 that I became CEO.
Okay. And CEO, are you owner too, or are you just CEO?
So right now we're going through the transition process of ownership. So my partner, Sarah, who's the COO, and I are acquiring the firm from Lucy and Carolyn, who Carolyn's retiring at the end of this year. And then a couple of years down the road, whenever Lucy decides that she wants to move on, she can retire as well. So,
yeah. Okay. So you're going to go through the employee acquisition process and then just do a seller finance type thing or get a loan. All right, yep. Cool. That's interesting too. So as you're growing, you became the CEO at what point, at what stage?
2020.
Which is also very interesting, running a firm and turning an employee into the CEO. I mean, this is still pretty rare in our space for the owner to kind of take a step back and then now have an operations and CEO that isn't even owner.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a long-term game plan of this is kind of the course that we're going to take, but it's a good model for kind of having training wheels for a while for the taking on the ownership where you're just taking care of the day to day. And both Lucy and Carolyn have been really good about that and basically allowing us to run the firm for the last few years with their input. And basically it's a gradual transition of more control shifting over to Sarah and I and how the business works from day to day and less from them over the course of, 3 or 4 years now we've had this game plan.
Yeah. So you said over the course and we charted the course. Did you take any courses? Were there any things that you model off of in business, or was there any to turn this into a business and run it like a business? Because if you modeled off of how to run an accounting practice, that's nightmare. It doesn't sound like you followed that model.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing I found, and I don't know if I want to, this might be a little bit might upset some people. I really don't like the partnership model in that you go through this entire process and then you become a partner and then you strike it rich. And then I've seen that in reading Reddit or conversations that I've had with other accountants where they basically like in working their first few years in accounting to like what it would be like for me as a chef to stage at a really good restaurant where they just treat you like crap and then churn you out. And maybe you turn into a diamond, or maybe you just get burnt out and leave the industry.
Like the Hell's Kitchen scenario?
Yeah, exactly. And I'd been through that myself in the hospitality industry, and I knew that that isn't something that I would want to have be the same impact that I want for other people coming into the industry, especially considering the shortages. And so, you know, we're thinking long term about how we want this business to be formed, and it having all of the power be at the top is not necessarily what we're looking to happen.
I love that. You know, we're writing a book here at Accounting High, and we're calling it How to Run a Practice. There was an old method of how to manage a practice. They called it MAP, how to manage a practice. And that was the traditional partnership method. That was the way practices had been run over most of our, you know, at least most of the history of running a practice. This is the old traditional way. And it wasn't until the cloud came in around 2012 that things started really changing, and that we started to see some huge shifts in running practices and seeing people do it differently. And now that's the book. The book is going to model off of the people doing it differently, the Acuities of the world, the Summits of the world, the Prefixes of the world, the firms that are doing things and making moves and changing the way you can run a practice and seeing it as a business and running it like a business and scaling it like a business and not bottlenecking it like a partnership. Partnerships bottled at the top of each funnel. Each partner is its own little silo. And that's all they are silos with shared resources. So we're looking at what are the ways to evolve the business, evolve this and turn this into an actual business that could be sustainable beyond just the bottleneck of one partner or one person at the top. Not only that, but doing things differently, as in picking a niche and marketing toward that niche or growing through that niche and finding unique different ways to present yourselves that are true to you. And what I found is the most effective niches at firms are the ones that have a history in that industry, that came from that industry and brought their knowledge from that industry and bridged it into how can we help financially and how can we help do other things. We still haven't talked about exactly like what you do for your clients besides just the books, but I feel like there's a lot more we can do for our clients, and that's where the advisory comes in. That's where all of the other cool, fun stuff you can do and the stuff with much higher margins that you can do with a client beyond just the compliance. Mm-hmm. So when you guys were custom business solutions, it was probably just a lot of just moving numbers around and handing reports and just compliance work. Did the nature of the work you guys do with the clients change?
Yeah, pretty significantly. We did some like fractional CFO work and things like that for a couple of companies, but most of our bread and butter was in CAS and payroll. We have since narrowed down the focus quite a bit. So the name Prefix is derived from a French term and a hospitality term, which is basically chef's choice.
Love that. Yeah.
So basically the menu is set before you. If you've ever gone to had a Prefix menu before, the coursing is set out for you. There's a supplement for wine.
That. I hate making choices at restaurants. Mm-hmm. This is so awesome.
Exactly. So the idea behind this is that it's the same thing, but for your accounting. There aren't any packages to choose. There are some supplements that you can choose.
Just like at a Prefix menu.
Exactly. Yeah. So you want to add caviar onto your as a supplement to your Prefix menu, great. Or a wine supplement, great. But the menu is set. So
or
what
you
we
do non-alcoholic or something.
Yeah. So essentially the idea behind that is that we're doing the same thing for every single client, no matter what. So we're not trying to figure out like, oh, are we doing cash
Your
management
sales
for
process
them?
Is so much easier. Smoother.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet you for the buyer too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The right buyer.
Mm-hmm. So essentially we're doing for every single client, we're doing AP entry. We're doing full accrual accounting. We're doing AP entry. We're doing bill pay. We're doing cash management. We're doing reconciliations, monthly closes, monthly financials, and then hour-long advisory meeting with the client to review the financials and do a deep dive into what we can see from those. They have the ability to supplement it with payroll if they want to. And long-term, what we're hoping to do is to be able to add other supplements in the form of tax, HR, some operational consulting, maybe even beverage consulting, and really try to end up being the back of house or the back office for
back
a restaurant.
Office, not back of house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For restaurants, because that's usually the thing they just don't have time for.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so back to you setting the tone from the beginning. It's a great way to weed out the wrong client too. Mm-hmm. You've already weeded out all other industries. You're not mm-hmm. taking any of them on. Mm-hmm. You guys are very clear about that. But then also, for the ones that you're made for, they know what prefix means. They know mm-hmm. a lot of the phrases and the things that you're doing. And they've already been creeping on you for a little while anyway, in most cases. They're coming to you pretty much knowing what they want. And you already know what you're going to give them. And they're coming for that experience too. So that's mm-hmm. you're setting the tone from the beginning. You're different than most all others out there. There's not too many accounting firms that are doing what you guys are doing for the restaurant industry. You probably know your competition in a lot mm-hmm. of ways. It's across the country, and you've got your set way of doing things. It's probably real refreshing to a lot of them. Some people could be turned off from that process, but that's how you weed out in the beginning. And you mm-hmm. set the tone for a long-term relationship with this passionate restaurant owner. So typically they're owned, you know, these aren't large, or are they like multi-person owned, or are you dealing with the owner? Like, tell me a little bit about that too.
So generally speaking, we're looking at restaurants that are anywhere between 800,000 to 5 million in revenue. So a $5 million restaurant is a monster. And generally we're looking that they only have one to maybe three concepts. If they have anything more than three concepts, or they're more than $5 million, they usually should just have somebody in-house. It's best for them that they have somebody in-house at that point.
Yeah.
And so there are some that have investors. For the most part, they are self-funded, or there's a limited number of partners involved in the business. And so we don't generally do a lot of investor relations.
And roughly, what's the of a $5 million restaurant or $2 million restaurant, do they have multiple locations? What other types of complexities do you guys run into with these sizes?
The complexity is usually in the payroll, but you know, for most restaurants are anywhere between, the lion's share are anywhere between 1 and 1.5 million in a more rural area. In a city, it's probably closer to 3, depending on the number of seats. But you know, most of our clients are under 120 seats, so they're smaller. And so we don't have a lot of complexity on that side of things. Most of the complexity of working with the restaurant industry is in all of the labor compliance.
Okay. So now for the elephant in the room, you guys are building out this niche, building out this practice, changing everything that you've done. You've got this course that you set yourselves on. You're mm-hmm. growing. And then March of 2020, the world shuts down. Nobody can go to restaurants. Restaurants are closed. Did you contemplate suicide at this point? I mean, I'm not being dramatic here. Like, that would have been such a punch in the gut, like, or just like the worst. Like, to me, that's my biggest fear, is picking a niche and then facing now we all know how all this turned out, especially for restaurants. This is probably the biggest gift you could have been given. But in the beginning, for you, or you're like, am I going to have to find another job?
I remember, I think it was March 19th was the day that it was a Thursday evening, which is the night where all of the partners get together for dinner at one of our clients. And we were talking a little bit about it, and, you know, there was a couple of other of our other clients were actually at that restaurant as well. So one of them comes up, a married couple. There are two different restaurants. One of them's a hotel, one of them was a restaurant. And they come up to us, and we're talking a little about this COVID thing that's happening.
This is what we thought was going to be an epidemic. Like,
yeah. And at this point in time, we're like, this is probably not really going to affect us. Maybe some places in the city will close, but most of my client base is concentrated in the rural area outside of New York City and Boston. So, you know, we're kind of like, it'll be fine. And then one of them's like, well, one of the partners at this restaurant is suggesting that we close down for the weekend. And so I was like, that seems excessive. And this is Thursday night. And so we're like, yeah, it'll probably blow over. Well, Saturday morning, I distinctly remember that everything had changed, and we were talking with every single one of our clients by that morning and talking about doing mass layoffs and furloughs. So in the span of 72 hours, we went from thinking that this wasn't going to be a huge deal to, you know, a catastrophic disruption of the entire industry. So I don't think that there was any point in time through that entire situation that I thought that we were doomed. At that point in time, through 2019, it was a very good year for restaurants. A lot of restaurants were thinking about opening, a lot of them opening new locations. And so a lot of them had cash reserves ready to make those moves. And we went and we were like, right off of the bat, we're just like, we don't delay on making a decision. We make a decision now. And our recommendation is that you furlough people until you get a better idea of what the hell is going on, because you can't just pay them to... You can't just pay them and then run out of your cash reserves, which was not a popular opinion.
Well, it's, you know, in a lot of cases too, a lot of the staff, front of house staff, what were you paying them in the first place anyway? They were living off of tips in a lot of these restaurants.
Some of them. Most of our client base is a little bit more upscale.
Okay.
So their hourly rates are a little bit higher than, like, say, like a lot of like a diner might be.
Okay. Instead of $2 or $3, they're maybe paying $6 or $7, but they're probably still paying somewhat, or are they paying over minimum wage?
Oh yeah, probably closer to $10 or $15 at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, still it's not a huge amount of money without the tips.
Right. But still the back of house, you're paying them a full wage. Mm-hmm. They're not really working off of tips.
Yeah. But it was at that moment when we were talking about all of the layoffs and furlough that it kind of clicked with us that, like, oh, this isn't going to be a situation where we're not going to be able to survive this. It's just a matter of like, we're switching what we're doing
and navigating it differently.
Yeah. We're not doing CAS because there's no accounting to be done. We're doing pretty much exclusively advisory as we navigate all of these different Which situations.
PPP early stages. There was ERC came a little bit actually. Later. I think ERC came before, but then PPP superseded because if you had one, you couldn't do the other.
Correct. Yeah. And nobody wanted to do the ERC made no sense unless you had like a mountain of money and could wait for those credits to come back. So everybody did the PPP.
Right.
And it was a matter of, because this had all changed so many times. Like there was the EIDL, the ERC, the PPP, and then for restaurants, there was the RRF,
right.
The Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Yep.
And all of them were like overlapping in some ways or couldn't overlap. And if you did the restaurant revitalization, then you couldn't do this. And then there were some state things too. And every state had its own little like fun stuff that you could pick from.
Yep. There was a brief moment of time in which Massachusetts was like, well, we're going to tax the PPP proceeds.
Oh, North Carolina said that too for a brief period of time. Yeah. All kinds of stuff. Like all of this is happening. And so you guys are navigating it as in we're going to be the advisors to help advise what you should do. And were you charging differently? Like, you know, we kind of didn't talk about how you guys price, but you were offering one set of services for everybody. So you said, if we're going to do this, how did you navigate that? The charging of it.
So this is where it got a little bit fun, is that we turned around and said to our client base, we are going to cut, we do fixed rate, and fixed rate depending on a percentage of revenue. So it scales.
Your fixed rate is based on revenue of the restaurant.
Yep.
That's another really important differentiator too. And you don't have to reprice at any point because it's always repricing.
Yep. And then we also have a cost of living adjustment as well in there so that we can continue to increase rates for our staff as well. But yeah. So we essentially said, like, we realize that your revenue is zero at this point. So we'll cut our rates in half and continue to provide the services that we have. So we had to take a huge cut in revenue.
You cut your rates in half with an undetermined amount of time that you were going to do that?
Yeah.
Who made that decision? That's tough, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what else are we going to do? Otherwise, we're just going to get fired by all of our clients. And then
you're going to get furloughed.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were trying to, all right, so then, well, now we're going to get you free money.
Yes.
How were we going to charge you for that?
Yeah, I think that that's probably the area where I think that we missed the boat the most on is that we, especially for the PPP, we included that. So we really lost.
So did most firms. There.
Yeah.
We did for sure too.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the RRF and the ERC that we started to charge, and we just charged a percentage of whatever the amount received was.
Okay. Especially when it came to the amounts that people were getting for ERC.
Yeah. And the amount that the ERC farms were taking.
Yeah. The other ones were taking, which we still have. I still get phone calls from ERC farms.
So yeah, that was what it was. But for those people that are probably listening to this and saying like, oh, this sounds absolutely horrific. Why would I ever niche? At the same time, our lead funnel through this period of time was absolutely bonkers. It was insane. We got like all of the people that we had on our hunt list were calling. Everybody that was looking for help, and they weren't getting it from a lot of their like conventional accountants. And so our growth through that period was insane.
Well, yeah, that was the point that I wanted to drive in all of this is it's scary and there's potential to lose everything, but we have the hindsight of 2020 now. We're in 2023, so 2020 is hindsight, and we can see you like there was opportunity created through this. Restaurants now are running differently, but you got to see that evolution. Restaurants evolved, they pivoted, they opened up outdoor seating. Like every city I go to now, part of the street is sometimes converted into outdoor seating for that restaurant, which created atmosphere, which created a whole new way of having that experience now. Like it's rare that you see restaurants without that outdoor seating now. Almost all great restaurants in any city I've been to has a great outdoor patio, nice atmosphere, sometimes music, sometimes they've added different things. And that's just the in-person aspect. Takeout now has forever changed.
Yeah.
Forever changed. That's a huge arm in a lot of these restaurants that it wasn't a big source of revenue back then. So, and you also have, and I'm telling you this from a purveyor, like my buyer's experience at a restaurant has changed in so many different ways. Just like I was saying how accounting firms have changed since the cloud, restaurants have changed so much. Your staff count is dramatically less at most of these restaurants because people never really came back. So they found new innovative ways to service clients. You know, I don't like the QR code thing, but most restaurants now have a QR code for the menu. A lot of restaurants now, you can order straight from that QR code and you just have food runners and you could pay through that too. Mm-hmm. So everything's happening and it's almost self-service beyond even counter service. You've got some restaurants that converted to counter service. Everything has changed and you're witnessing this change and you're advising on this change as it's happening. You guys have become and you've made yourselves and turned yourself into the experts of the new way of running a restaurant because you were in the thick of it. So I think we all know, and we could all see that the worst case scenario happened and it became an opportunity and a best case scenario. So with the chaos and all the changes and everything happening, you guys still maintained the center of all the advice that your clients needed. They weren't really going anywhere else. If they did go somewhere else, somebody sent them to you. Mm-hmm. You guys became that centerpiece and it was their lifeline. And you're getting new business along the way too. And so the trust factor has amplified. The need for your service amplified. Did anything as far as your confidence level with some of these, did it change? Did it waver? Like, how did you feel advising them on this, you know, this time that was constantly changing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it improved our confidence in that there's a little bit of, you know, imposter syndrome when you start.
Yeah,
especially in anything, but especially when you're a specialist in a specific area. And it solidified the fact that, like, A, we knew what we were doing. B, we were doing something that no one else was doing, and we had a very unique product. And C, that, like, these sorts of economic downturns are honestly the best thing that can happen for our business because it will build a loyalty in our client base that is you can't match. And it probably was, you know, I hate saying this because it's at the cost of, you know, many people's jobs and a lot of turmoil and pain for a lot of restaurant owners, but it was one of the best things that probably happened to us.
Sure. And, you know, in some cases, some restaurants too, some people's lives, the best thing that happened to them was this change. They got out of a rut. There's a lot of things. And a lot of people found new careers too. Maybe people that worked in restaurants, the reason they're not coming back is because they found something else, you know? And so everybody's been adapting to this change, to this upheaval. And it sounds like in a lot of ways, you guys stayed pretty consistent. Like, did you have an office? Was there things that changed about the firm?
Yeah, we were, you know, we had started as a firm in an office that was, you know, everybody came into the office every day. We had started you know, transitioning towards, you know, you could work from home certain days before COVID. And we had hired our first remote employee.
That's what we had to.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We had one remote employee and you could do maybe a day of working at home.
Yep. And we obviously went to working remotely completely and have not gone back. We had a building. We had an office building that was dual zoned, so it could be residential or commercial. So we were insanely lucky there. So we were able to sell the building when we were in the middle of COVID, which is in the rural area, was quite good. And then now we do have a physical location that's a workshare space that we rent, but for pennies on the dollar compared to what we were paying for to maintain an office building.
What's the comparison?
It's like $750 a month for this office space, as opposed to like, I mean, I would have to run the numbers, but it's probably like $3,500 to maintain that building a month.
Okay. Yeah. Not even that, like whatever the rent was, but on top of the rent, you had every other expense that went with that too.
Yeah. It was it was an old colonial building. So, you know, heating it was basically like, you know, just like lighting heating oil on fire.
The supplies, the snacks, the everything, you know, cleaning.
And like the building was empty even when we were there. Like there were still, you know, multiple offices that were just open.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just paying for heating empty space for the most part.
That's crazy. So a lot has changed, a lot has evolved, but it made you guys stronger, probably more profitable in the long run. In the short term, you did have to take a hit. But everybody did, and you guys probably got some form of PPP yourselves.
Yeah. I mean, and we also, you know, I think we were down like, we weren't down 20%, but we were down like a little under 20% for that year. But if we, you know, we cut our billables by 50 and then we're up.
You're still up.
Yeah.
New clients. Yeah.
Yeah.
And everything else. Yeah. No, I feel you. This is a valuable lesson in, and going back to the beginning, you guys really did start with the minority of your clients were hospitality, restaurant, service based. So it wasn't like you had a large base of clients that you said, we're going all in on this. You went in on a minority. It became the majority and it was potentially threatened to completely shut down. If you were really short-sighted, you guys could have picked up them left and took on other clients too. Mm-hmm. But you stuck with it through the hardest of times and only made you guys stronger. Very valuable lesson in thinking long-term and staying the course. You know, that was just one thing you said, like we charted the course and you saw that course. Now that course took a couple of detours, I'm sure, but you're still on track and it sounds like you're still on course toward that North Star, wherever you were walking toward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a journey, you know, maybe little tiny sprints along the way, but a lot of it's a long game and it's a long, you know, it's a long short course that you charted. You're the CEO of this firm. You're going to be the owner. What's one of the most valuable things that you've learned along the way? Could just be a life lesson.
The thing I wasn't anticipating in choosing a niche that I want to say was one of the best unintended, I don't want to say consequences, but
outcomes.
Outcomes, yes. Is that choosing a niche makes building a company culture significantly easier. And, you know, for us, our restaurant, we hire accountants that have worked in the restaurant industry. It's one of the prerequisites to the job. If you haven't, then getting hired here is going to be a much higher bar. We only have one employee that isn't or has not.
And that's very unique. You're looking to find a job at an accounting firm and your resume ought to have experience in QuickBooks or something like that. No, your resume ought to have, I worked in the front of house at this restaurant. I was a server here. I was a bartender mm-hmm. here. I worked in the back. I was mm-hmm. a cook. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah. And it, you know, if you've ever worked in the restaurant industry, you know that it's a family, regardless of whether or not you,
sure.
Whether or not you like that person or not. It builds a rapport with each other because you've all suffered through it together. Yeah, exactly. It's an unspoken bond. And it makes building a company much easier because all of those people have that same bond because they've all been through it. And so regardless of whether or not it's the restaurant industry or construction or whatever you choose that niche to be, if you are going to go down this path, try to pick a niche where you can utilize that to your advantage, because our employees' first days are that much easier because they already have some life experience that they can share outside of accounting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's outside of the day-to-day mm-hmm. that they have that bond. It isn't just, oh, I worked at this firm, because then that mm-hmm. becomes a little shallow, because then it's not your outside stuff that pulls in the common thread. That's amazing. That's beautiful. I got an anecdotal story. I met my wife while we were working at a restaurant. She was a busser. I was a server. And she didn't speak English, but we worked so well together. Like all the unspoken mm-hmm. stuff that happens at a restaurant, how fast the time goes, especially when it's a real busy restaurant. She picked up what I was putting down without the verbal communication. It was all, a lot of it was nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the combo that got me the best tips too, because plates were always cleared if they were empty. Drinks were always full. Everything that they needed, she anticipated the needs, their needs at the table and my needs. And there's so many things that happen within a restaurant in that time. You've got to be quick. You've got to be able to do a few things at once and be running around while you're thinking. And it, you can't have too many verbal cues. Mm-hmm. So things have to happen. And the ones that really click and the ones that really work, they can succeed and they do very well. And the other ones at a restaurant, it's just not for them. You know, the people that are just going to stand around idle. You know, you need to have initiative and you need to go forward. And that skill set really can't be taught. And you carry that with you in mm-hmm. other jobs, in other roles. I mean, my wife, obviously, she carried it with her to run our house. Our house is run with that mentality. Mm-hmm. Our kids are raised with that mentality. And that's a work ethic. That's something that somebody has internally. And it's, again, it's just not something that can be taught. So taking that and capturing that and pulling that into what you guys do now is more than a common bond. It's a way of life in a lot of ways. And you learn that through experience.
Yeah. And it's also like that sort of the, you know, the steps of service and like that sort of philosophy, like how a restaurant will serve a guest. One of my favorite topics is like how the parallels that you can draw between that and the client experience at an accounting firm.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot to be learned from how the hospitality industry successfully manages like these. And you get a chance to watch The Bear on Hulu, season 2, episode 7. It's the episode is called like Richie Stages Forks, I think. Where one of the characters stages at a Michelin restaurant and they go through like how they make the client experience like absolutely incredible.
Do you make your employees watch that episode now? Or you assume they already have?
They already have. Season 2 launched last week or the week before. They've already watched it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I didn't have to ask them to. They just, you know.
I've been watching Lil Dicky's show on Hulu. Dave. That's I would get Hulu just for that. I think we have somebody else's account we're logged into. I don't even know what it is, but yeah, that was the only show. But now that's on my queue.
Yeah.
The Bear.
Oh, it's great. It's fantastic.
Dope. But,
yeah.
Well, Chris, this has been awesome. I mean, I think there's so many other things that we can talk about that we can go into. But one tip that you gave me when we first met was episodes need to be a little bit shorter. You know, you're running these 2-hour episodes, hour and a half episodes, and I don't have time to listen to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So let's keep them a little shorter. And I've been intentionally trying to do that. I think, you know, anywhere between 45 to maybe an hour and 5 minutes is what I've been keeping it to. because I do think that sometimes the conversation really gets good once the, you know, once the interview is started, once you're like 30 minutes in, that's when we got to the meat of it. So I like these to run as a conversation, and I think this was beautiful. You're awesome, Chris. I love what you're doing. I'm excited to continue to see where your course has charted to and where it's going. I really would love to talk about the next time the ownership model and the way that you guys structured that, and the way that, you know, after you've gone through it and after that's done, we'll have you back on and talk about that experience too.
Yeah, totally.
That'll be dope. I wish you the best and appreciate you for coming on.
It's always good talking with you, man.
Class dismissed.